Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com.
Hello, this is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Medicine. In particular, this is the first of a pair of interviews on communication in healthcare today. We tend to think of medical advances in terms of biology and technology, new drugs, targeted cancer therapies, and surgery with lasers. But all of these advances represent only a single aspect of how patients experience the healthcare system. In their book, Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare, published by Oxford University Press in 2016, physicians Saul Wiener and psychologist Alan Schwartz argue for a different kind of revolution in healthcare, listening better to patients to glean broader context about their lives that might lead to more effective care. The book offers countless harrowing, and dare I say fascinating, examples of when details not usually encountered in the context of the clinic really come to matter. While the problem itself is easy to articulate anecdotally, it is unusually difficult to measure. Wiener and Schwartz provide a clear and engaging walkthrough of their creative approaches to empirically studying this phenomenon and offer crucial recommendations for how it can be addressed. As they both work in medical education, they have a strong appreciation for the battleground of priorities that is the modern clinic. Institutional strictures for measuring quality often conflict with the ability of individuals to provide excellent care, so their approach is wholesale. Change how doctors are trained along with these measures. They even offer words of advice for how patients can better cue their doctors into their own context. As such, this is a book for those who work in various aspects of healthcare, along with those of us who inevitably experience it. I enjoyed my discussion with Saul and Alan, and I think you will too. Hi everyone, this is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Medicine. I'm here today at the University of Illinois Chicago in the Department of Medical Education, speaking with Saul Wiener and Alan Schwartz about their new book, Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare. Saul, Alan, welcome to New Books in Medicine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the way we like to get things started here is for our authors to give us a little bit of context on how they got into their respective fields and also how the work at hand came about. So shall we start with you, Saul?
Sure. Thank you. So, well, if we go back far enough, I would say that it began with my having a dad who was a social scientist and me wanting to be a physician. So ultimately these two areas kind of came together. I was actually in college. I did my thesis on the development of the allopathic medical profession in Nepal and realized that I really loved looking at medicine from a social science perspective. When I was in medical school, I ended up doing research looking at what happens when people who don't have health insurance trying to get care. And again, really enjoyed that kind of social science perspective. When I was a resident, quite frankly, all I could do was show up and get through the day. No research during those 4 years. Ended up training as both an internist and a pediatrician through a dual program. And then I got here around 1997. And actually, Alan and I met not long after that. And initially, my research focused on health policy, on the issue of access to care for the uninsured. But I started to realize that we didn't really need any more papers published on why it's bad not to have health insurance, that this was pretty obvious, and that it was something I was more interested in being an activist about than trying to answer research questions. And I think what got me interested in this topic came more from actually just taking care of patients and teaching residents and medical students. And one of the things I started to notice is that young doctors were getting better and better at what we call evidence-based medicine, which is kind of knowing what the latest research evidence is and the treatment guidelines are. And they could kind of rattle those off, often better than me. But what I would discover when I walked into the room to see the patient after I'd kind of heard this very elegant presentation is that there were things going on in that person's life that really complicated everything, and that, you know, the perfect medicine was not affordable, or the dose that they were supposed to be taking, they weren't able to read the instructions, or they had lost somebody in their life who had been helping them manage their medication because their vision was failing. I mean, on and on and on. And what looked like a perfect plan of care would suddenly look like it just wasn't going to make sense for that person at all. And so I started to realize that there was this whole area of kind of quality and performance that, quite frankly, was very important and that wasn't really getting measured or looked at. I'll let Alan tell sort of his side in a minute, but ultimately I found my way to Alan because I needed help developing a research method for looking at this very complex question of how do we evaluate physicians at this very kind of abstract skill, which is taking into account the life context of patients when planning their care.
And so I also got here in 1997. I came from Berkeley, where I was a cognitive psychologist, yeah, still a cognitive psychologist, interested in human judgment decision making, and in particular, interested in medical decisions. I knew that I really enjoyed the experimental method, but I didn't want to spend my life in a lab putting people in front of computers and making them do, you know, repetitive tasks. I wanted to get out into some decisions that I thought were more consequential and important. So I came here to work in medical decision making. And actually, when Saul and I met, I was teaching evidence-based medicine in pediatrics, trying to both help physicians in training get better at understanding the research literature that might give them some guidelines for what they should do with patients on average. And also studying the way that physicians change their minds about treatments based on the evidence that they saw in the research literature. So the other side of that, of course, is, well, what if the patient isn't like the average? And that's really, I think, in many ways, the question that Saul came to and that really got us working together.
Mm-hmm. There was one really memorable patient that stood out for me early on that I ended up writing about that I think kind of captures what it is that we're trying to talk about here. I was working in the preoperative testing clinic, which is where patients are sent before they go to surgery. And I was supervising that clinic, and residents would see the patient and would come to talk to me. And there was this woman who'd come in, and she was being prepped for bariatric surgery, for weight loss surgery. And the resident came back and said, you know, Mrs. So-and-so is here for a preoperative bariatric surgery evaluation. She's basically in pretty good health. She's not been successful losing weight using conservative measures. She was seen in the obesity clinic for a while, weight loss clinic, and referred to surgery because she developed hypertension and hyperlipidemia, which are complications of her obesity. So she meets all of the evidence-based criteria for being appropriate for this surgery, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we did her EKG, looks fine. You know, she's looking forward to having the surgery because she thinks she'll be able to, you know, take better care of an ill son. And so I think that she's basically, all prepped and ready to go. I think we can say that she's cleared for surgery. So I heard all this, and, you know, again, all the evidence-based stuff sounded good, met the criteria, had not been successful with other more conservative measures. So I said, well, what's wrong with the son? You know, what's this about her son who's ill? And the resident said, looked at me and was like, well, I don't know. Like, you know, why are we talking about the son? The son's not our patient. So I was like, well, I don't know. I was just curious. So we walked in there. And I think what struck me is that it just seemed like an unusual comment for a patient to make. You know, I'm looking forward to taking better care of my son. Usually people just don't disclose things like that. So I asked her about it, and it turned out that her son had muscular dystrophy and was in his early 20s. He was at a very advanced stage. She basically had to care for everything. She had to lift him and bathe him, and she was pretty much his life support. And she had this idea that if she lost weight, she'd be better able to do that. But what she really hadn't taken into account is that if she had the surgery, she wouldn't be able to do anything or any weightlifting, like lifting her son, for about 40 days. And if she tried to do it, she would be at risk of wound dehiscence, tearing open the wound in her abdomen. And so she'd been so focused on the positives of the surgery that she hadn't really thought about, you know, the long-term consequences. The intermediate consequences, the issue of not being able to do what was so important to her. So I asked her if she had anyone who could help with her son, and it turned out that she had a young daughter who was about 12, who also really depended on her, and a husband who was an alcoholic and kind of abusive. She hadn't thrown him out because he brought in basically a disability check. And so she was kind of holding the family together. And what became clear from this conversation is that this was absolutely the wrong time for her to have surgery. That if she went and had surgery, it would be a disaster for her. And quite frankly, her major reason for having the surgery, which was to take care of her son, would not be realized. And so she ended up saying, no, actually, I don't want the surgery, when she realized it. And I sort of joked about the fact later that she, you know, failed preoperative assessment on psychosocial grounds, which is, you know, really pretty much what happened. And so when Alan and I started to talk about this case, we realized that if you put this into a conceptual framework, there are really four kinds of information that should go into every medical decision. One of them is what we call the clinical presentation. So what are the biomedical issues in this patient? It's like that they have obesity, they have comorbidities like hypertension and hyperlipidemia, all of these biomedical things that we talk about. That's sort of the clinical presentation. Then there's the research evidence, which is what are the guidelines for this? Well, the guidelines are yes, you should go to surgery if you're developing complications and other methods have failed. All that's clear. But there's two more types of information you need. One is you need to know what are the patient's what's the patient's preferences if there are choices in therapy. And obviously a preference is something that a person can only decide for themselves. So if there are different options for treatment and they have different risks and benefits, only the patient can decide. So they call that preferences. And the fourth one is context. What's going on in that person's life that could be relevant to determining whether, in fact, those preferences will be realized. So in this particular case, the resident had done a great job of picking up on the research evidence for the clinical presentation, but that was it. They hadn't looked at these other types of information, which is what is the context and what are the preferences. And so our work has really been about studying whether physicians are picking up on these contextual issues when they really matter. And that is kind of the framework for what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of context and playing on some of what both of you have just said, in the introduction to the book, you frame the work being done as part of a trajectory toward the improvement of quality of healthcare that was kind of two-pronged in a way. And one of these prongs is based in evidence-based medicine, which both of you have brought up, and the other is in sort of drives to humanize medicine. And I was wondering if both or either of you could give a little more context for our listeners who are sort of less familiar with the climate of American medicine in the 1980s and on. So how would you define evidence-based medicine? How has it unfolded and how has it affected practice in hospitals and in medical education? And then where do you see, what are some sort of standouts of humanistic medicine endeavors, some kind of touchstones of that?
I'll take the evidence-based medicine one and I'll give you the other one. So there were studies that came out in the early 80s that pointed out substantial variation in the way people got taken care of. And it didn't look like this really had anything to do with the patients. So
patients who were similar were getting treated very differently depending on where you were in the country or even where you were in the city. So if you are in a clinical situation where there's a right thing to do or a more right thing to do and people are getting different things, that's a problem. Some people are not getting what they ought to be getting. So the kind of evidence-based medicine educational movement, which really came a lot out of the UK, Canada, and then some centers in the United States, was about teaching physicians how to read the research literature so they could understand for themselves like what is the current state of the art of practice for a particular condition. So teaching physicians how to ask questions about their patients and then to go and search in the medical literature to understand enough about study design and statistics that they could read those studies and they could draw a conclusion. And presumably that would be the conclusion that any physician facing a patient like this with a question like that would draw. So it was really a move towards standardization of care in a lot of ways and standardizing it on the most, as they say, evidence-based, the most up-to-date research around that particular problem. So that was a big, was introduced in a big way into medical education in the 80s. At the time, it was an innovation. Now it's sort of the standard practice. Every medical school teaches every medical student and every resident about evidence-based practice. They're supposed to learn how to look at the literature, how to understand some of that primary research. Of course, as we mentioned earlier, no patient is really the average patient in a research study, right? And research studies don't investigate the individual contextual differences in patients.
Yeah, and I think to take that sort of to the second part of your question about humanism, there's been a lot of talk in the last 20 or so years about making medicine more humanistic, about physicians needing to be more empathic. And I think the challenge, of course, is assessing whether that's actually happening and being clear about what you mean when you use those words. Our approach has been quite pragmatic. As we see it, what patients want are really two things. One is they want to know that their doctor has got the science right. We can call that evidence-based practice. But what they also need is that care plan is ultimately appropriate for them. And in order for it to be appropriate for them, we get to those two additional types of information I was talking about that are often missing. One is it has to be mindful of their preferences. It has to be respectful of their personal choices about the kind of risks and benefits they want to take, surgery versus waiting, whatever the choice is, medication versus observation. So that's one part. And the other is it needs to be attentive to their life context, and that's those are actually measurable. So, but to measure them, we had to really develop some new techniques. And one of the things that became clear when Al and I were talking about this over 10 years ago was that the only way to really assess whether physicians are picking up on these contextual factors is to be a fly on the wall during a visit. And there were really only two ways of doing it. The first was sending in fake patients who were trained to essentially say the same thing over and over again and drop the same clues that they're having life challenges and see what happens and have them carrying concealed audio recorders. That's what we call the unannounced standardized patient. It's basically like a mystery shopper who's trained to do the same thing over and over again and to collect very specific data and to record what happens. So we ended up getting grant money and hiring a team of actors who became undercover patients. And we sent them into lots and lots of practices. So, for instance, we could send an actor into 50 practices, and he would do the same thing. He would come in, and he would say he's got a history of asthma. It's been getting worse. He, at a particular point, he would say, oh, and doc, it's been tough since I've lost my job. And then when he was asked what medicine he was taking, he would give the name of a really expensive brand name inhaler when there are lots of cheaper generics you could be using. And we'd listen to see what happens. So the doctor who's attentive would say, wow, what's going on with you losing your job? Are you having trouble paying for your meds? Have you lost your health insurance? And the actor would say, yeah. And the doctor would hopefully look and see that he was on an unnecessary, expensive, brand-name drug and say, well, we can fix that. We'll just put you on a cheap generic. How's that? And the patient would be like, that's terrific. Okay. Believe it or not, that happens less than a quarter of the time. And we know that because we listen. And we've been listening to, at this point, thousands of visits. And so what unfortunately happens are the following. One is the patient will say, boy, it's been tough since I lost my job. And the doctor might say, yeah, you know, it's been a really tough economy. I'm sorry to hear that. Do you have any allergies? Like, they would be sort of sympathetic. They'd say something kind of nice. But then they would just plunge ahead. And I think that, you know, that's like very narrow blinders. They have this very biomedical, like, focus. And they just think that, oh, that's just like a sad little thing he told me. I should just say something nice and move on. Whereas some doctors recognize, oh, my goodness, that's data. Like, they just told me something that's equivalent to my abdomen's hurting. Or, you know, I can't see straight. It's like it's information. And then they will pursue it. They'll ask questions about it. So it's interesting that some physicians have a wider angle lens on. And if you think about it, context is nothing more than like opening up the lens, right? So you're no longer just looking narrowly at this biomedical stuff, and you're opening up the lens. And the goal is that your patient will walk out with a care plan that's actually customized to them. So we use this method of sending in fake patients to gather a ton of data on what we ended up calling contextual error. So a contextual error is a kind of error that describes this phenomenon of getting the science right but the care plan wrong. And what's interesting about contextual errors is they're invisible unless you're there observing them happening. Because if you look at the medical record, which is the way most quality of care is done, it always looks internally consistent. Because if the doctor missed the significance of something the patient said, it won't be in the chart. The doctor isn't going to say, they're not going to write, I missed the fact that he said he has lost his job. They're just going to say, patient came in, asthma's been getting worse, I added a new medicine, you know, and I ordered the following tests. Okay, and it's going to look terrific. If anyone audits, it looks terrific. But in fact, it's lousy care. And so what we discovered after doing a lot of this is a couple things. First of all, this problem is common. Two, it's totally not being detected because no one's listening in on visits. Three, we ended up looking at the costs. And so we found out that when doctors basically miss this stuff, they tend to order lots of tests because they don't really know what's going on. And we did that because the way we did that is we basically let these doctors order labs and put in other orders before we told them they'd seen a fake patient. So we would only tell them they saw a fake patient after they had already put in the orders. And that way, we knew what they would have done had it been a real patient. And we found that when they missed the context, when they made these contextual errors, they ordered a lot of unnecessary tests. So it drives. So we can tell you that contextual errors cost a lot. They're expensive. And then later, we did a project where we trained, we invited almost 1,000 real patients to carry concealed audio recorders into their visits, which I don't think has been done. And again, that opened up a whole window of insight, which we can talk about as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to hear more about what some of these examples of contextual errors are, because the book is, you know, full of very, very rich descriptions of patient histories and kind of really gets you into that process of clinical reasoning.
Yeah.
But so one interesting case that you discussed related to this idea of a fundamental attribution error, where something that is construed as kind of a personality defect or some kind of undesirable substrate of an interaction, as opposed to something that is fundamental information about the patient's case. So something that would otherwise be written off as personality is actually, you know, really the crux of a case. So could you go into some of these, the nature of some of these kinds of errors?
Yeah, I mean, we see that all the time when it comes to medication adherence, for example. Mm-hmm. So if I forget to take one of my daily meds, I know that it's because I was out late and I forgot about it, or there was something went on in my life and it was kind of stressful and it didn't happen, and, you know, I'll try to do better. If I go to some physicians and they discover that I forgot to take a daily med, their feeling is, well, so this is a patient who's not adherent with medication, right? It's some kind of essence about me that I'm no good at taking meds on time.
Mm-hmm.
And so patients get these labels, right, not adherent or not compliant, that kind of follow them around. And it may be that those labels themselves prevent the physician from really looking into, well, what's going on? What is the context? Why is it that it's difficult for you to take those meds that way?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting. When we make assumptions about people, we stop being curious and we stop asking questions because we think we know the answer. Oh, yeah, the reason he doesn't take his medication is because he just doesn't care. He's not concerned about his health. He doesn't understand that it's a priority, and I'll just lecture him. I'll tell him he needs to do better, okay? When in fact, if instead you said, Mr. Jones, I've noticed that your diabetes control has been getting worse and worse. Like, you used to do a great job. Your, what we call the hemoglobin A1C, used to be really normal, and now it's going way up. Your sugars are way out of control. You know, what's going on? Okay. Then you will learn why that patient is struggling. And what you find will be variable, but it could be something very significant that you could fix. You know, I had a truck driver who he became a truck driver, and his insulin was freezing. And so he wasn't taking his insulin. I've had patients who I work in the night shift, and so they can't take their medication at the right time. And I mean, just the list goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And we actually made a list once of 54 answers patients give that are all different from each other when you ask them why they're not taking their medication. And they surprise physicians, because physicians are just labeling them as non-compliant. And what's fascinating is most of these are fixable.
Right.
And so I think the fundamental attribution error is unfortunately at the root of a lot of judgmentalism. It leads us to judge others, and when we judge others, we stop asking questions, and then we no longer get them the care they need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, speaking of asking questions and investigating these kinds of things, I'm interested in unpacking a bit more the process of creating, I guess, the scripts for these unannounced standard patients, and also what it was like to, you know, try to, where did you guys derive influence to use that model to assess this problem? Because it's an interesting approach.
Yeah, one of the things that was really convenient is that all medical schools now have a stable of standardized patients. Mm-hmm. They use primarily to teach sort of the art of doctoring kind of stuff, to assess communication skills. So medical students will go and they'll examine a standardized patient in a kind of lab room, and the patient will play the case, and at the end of the case, the patient usually gives feedback to the student. You know, this is how you spoke to me, and how I felt about it, and how it went, and so on. And this has become a very common in medical education, both for instruction and for assessment. It's used in major exams. So there was already a stable of actors, right? People who knew how to pretty convincingly portray patients with a variety of different kinds of conditions. So that really was a kind of the genesis of the idea that, well, what if these people could do this in a way that the provider examining them didn't know,
right,
that they were seeing an actor. Right? in terms of how we actually developed the cases, I think most of those came from the observations you made of what was going on with residents.
Absolutely. Basically just keeping a diary on real cases and saying, well, we can train an actor to portray these. You know, the example I gave you is just one of many. And so, you know, we had, for example, I remember when I was, I take care of patients in the hospital as well as on the wards, in the clinic. And I remember one day, the way it works here is you go on service at the beginning of every month. So you're on service as an attending for 30 days, and you supervise a team of residents and medical students. So it was my day to come on service, which means you inherit all the patients of the doctor who's going off service. And one of my patients was an elderly gentleman who was being worked up, evaluated for unexplained weight loss. And typically, if you've got somebody in their 70s who's losing weight, you worry about cancer, unexplained weight loss. It's kind of a buzzword in medicine. And that means, boy, you better go looking. You better do a CT scan and a colonoscopy and whatever, all these different tests. Find out, what is it? They have colon cancer, breast, well, why is this person losing weight? Okay. So I inherited this guy. He'd been on the ward for several days, getting a bunch of tests. And I started chatting with him, and it didn't take long to learn that he was kind of borderline homeless. He'd been sleeping in somebody's basement, and basically he was hungry. He had been having a hard time going to shelters. He didn't feel safe there. He was concerned about being beat up. He wasn't getting basically a square meal, only a few times a week. And the reason this guy was losing weight was because he was starving. And so obviously working him up for a bunch of cancers was just a huge waste of time, very expensive, and completely a contextual error. Now, if you just looked at the chart, it looked totally appropriate. You know, 73-year-old mm-hmm. gentleman comes in with unexplained weight loss, blah, blah, blah. You know, differential diagnosis includes colon cancer, whatever, et cetera. So it all looks good on paper. If it was audited, it would fly through. Utilization review would fly through. But if you knew what was going on, you'd be like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
So what do? We trained an actor who was in his 70s to go to practices and give four clues that he was homeless and say he was losing weight and see what happens. And again, more than half the time, he walked out and the doctor put in orders for all kinds of malignancy workup.
And then you had to quickly intervene and
quickly say,
cancel them because
fake, sense fake. Exactly, yeah. Now, in most of the in a minority of cases, the doctor would figure out, you know, the guy was homeless. I mean, he would pick up on the clues when the patient, you know, first of all, the patient would dress like he was kind of on the margins. So we basically would, in those cases, often it would be like Meals on Wheels or a social work consult or something very inexpensive and direct. And so what we did is we based our cases that we trained actors on these real cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, you guys describe one of the limitations of this approach is almost, you know, its scientificity, right? You have a clearly defined set of scripts that you're having actors go out, and so you can, you can sort of compare across responses what different physicians' reactions are. So what were some of the unique difficulties of actually implementing this with real patients?
So, first of all, no one had ever done it before. People had used unannounced anesthetized patients before. It's, by the way, which is still kind of tricky because you've got to create like fake insurance and a fake medical record, and and essentially, you know, it's pretty tricky. You've got to get the practice to agree to it, and that's a long. We write about that in the book,
right? Unearthing old social security numbers,
all that kind of stuff. Yes. So we had to wrestle with that. We weren't the first people to do it. I think ours is the largest study that's been done, but it was not the first. Mm-hmm. Whereas essentially inviting real patients to carry concealed audio recorders into their visits, no one else has still done. I mean, I think we're still the first to do that. But the challenges there so first, you need to make sure that that everyone is comfortable with the plan. So, you know, the patients have to feel like if they're going to record their visit, that data is going to be very, very secure. It's not going to get into the wrong hands because they're talking about personal stuff. They have to feel totally comfortable with it. The doctors have to understand that the data will never be used against them. It's entirely for research as you know, later we actually use it for quality improvement. And then at a conceptual or methodological level, there's one big difference, which is that with fake patients, we know what they're going to say, and we know how to evaluate the physician based on their response to what the patient says. It's an experiment. Right. Whereas with real patients, we have no idea what they're going to say. We don't even know if they're going to be contextual issues. So we had to develop a coding system for listening to audio recordings where we could, with a high degree of inter-rater reliability, which means different people would come to the same conclusion listening to the same audio recording, essentially determine whether the doctor had picked up on these contextual issues and addressed them. And so we kind of had to develop a schema for tracking that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this was a highly collaborative process. You guys described the kind of non-traditional actors in medical research that you brought on board to actually engage in this. So, yeah, I'd be interested to hear more about what are some of the factors that you look for when coding, and what, you know, what was the kind of process that went into generating what you guys call in the book 4C, or as I have it here, context coding for contextualization of care.
Yeah, close. Content.
Content coding. Content coding. I always do that. I'm leaping straight to content. So.
Right. Sure. Well, and that's important because a lot of the systems and approaches that have been used to look at recorded visits, you know, not usually covertly recorded visits, but overtly recorded visits, have not focused on what the actual medical conversation is. They focused on communication behaviors, like is the physician nodding and saying yes and summarizing and things like that. So we realized that in order to study what we wanted to study, the ability to pick up on context and appropriately plan care, you had to go beyond just looking at what are the kind of acontextual, if you like, the non-medical communications behaviors that are involved, and look at the actual content of the conversation. So we look to see our coders, when they're listening to the recordings, look to see, did the patient say something that we call a red flag that makes you think that maybe there is something else going on here beyond the medical case that's being presented? Something like, it's been tough since I lost my job. If the patient drops a contextual red flag, then we expect the physician to do something about that. So our coders try to come up with, well, what ought the physician to ask at this point? What would be an ideal probe to find out if there really is something behind that red flag?
and they listen to see if the physician does something more or less like that contextual probe.
Mm-hmm.
If they do, then maybe the patient reveals that there is a contextual factor in the case. So, yes, I've lost my job and now I can't afford my meds. Or maybe the patient reveals that that red flag doesn't actually signal a contextual factor that's relevant to this problem. I've lost my job, but my wife still has hers and I'm on her insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a contextual factor then that's identified as a result of this probe, or because the patient just comes out and says, you know, without prompting, now I don't have insurance and I can't afford this medication. Once we know that there's a contextual factor, then we can ask, so what did the physician do about it? And again, our coders come up with some ideas, some models of what would be an appropriate care plan that would take that context into account. And they listen to see if the physician actually implements a plan like that. In some cases where in many of our studies, we get the physician's note afterwards as well, so we can see whether they actually ordered a plan that would incorporate that kind of context.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, what Alan just walked through has a fair amount of jargon in it, and because we needed the jargon in order to code for specific things, but it really boils down to something very, very simple that people do all the time, which is if somebody says something that's a tip-off, that there's an issue, it could be you're with a friend and they just drop a comment, and you're like, whoa, what was that? Okay, that's the clue. You ask about it, that's the probe. They tell you something that you didn't know that's very significant that you need to do something about. That's the factor. And then you say, oh, gosh, I think I can help you with that. That's the contextualized care plan. So really, all we're doing is saying there's those four steps. And we listened for them on an audio recording, and we found that we can reach a high degree of inter-rater reliability. Different people will listen to the same audio recording and come to the same conclusions. But what's really interesting is we've discovered that we can then code each visit as either it was contextualized or there was a contextual error, okay? And we can then actually track the patients who were at those visits for up to 9 months. And what we found is that in those visits where the care plan was contextualized, that patient is more likely to do better. So what we can tell you is that contextualizing care actually predicts healthcare outcomes, which is stunning.
Mm-hmm.
And what and again, if you actually dig down into it, it's also obvious. So for instance, if we go back to the example I gave of, boy, it's been tough since I've lost my job, if you send that guy out on a higher dose of medication he's already not able to afford, he's not going to get better. On the other hand, if you switch him to a cheap generic, he's probably going to get better. Okay, so when you break it down to individual cases, it makes perfect sense. But we've just shown that it's true.
You know, you make a mistake, you're going to spend money and people aren't going to get better. And the problem with contextual errors is, until now, no one knew that those mistakes were being made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so in analyzing all this data you amassed, I believe in the fifth chapter, you begin to talk about characterizing what some of these successful behaviors might look like. And so just, I guess, 2 points on that. So one, what are some of those, what are some kind of successful strategies that physicians who are good contextualizers employ? And then two, what is this schema trying to get at? You both, what you write about in the book is describing how what you're interested in primarily in establishing the framework is sort of a minimum threshold for what competency of evaluating context is, that obviously every trained physician should aim to achieve higher than. But why not go for, you know, prescribing what ideal behaviors might look like in place of that?
Do you want to talk a little bit about the factors?
Well, I could take this. I was going to take the second question first. I think the reason for not sort of setting a very high bar is that if no one achieves that high bar, and based on our data, very, very few people would, you know, you don't have a lot to go with. You're telling a whole bunch of people, well, you're not up to snuff. Whereas if you have the lower bar, then we're certainly identifying the people below that who really need some help. And the people above that, yes, they can get better. And I'm sure later we'll talk about our QI project, where we've been helping everyone try to get better on an ongoing basis. But but you want it to really be unquestionable that this person who misses this bar is making mistakes that are serious mistakes. I don't want there to be any quibbles about that.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think we have a lower bar. We want to give the benefit of the doubt in many ways to the physician, because you know there are a lot of things that go on that we don't measure. And we want to be sure if we say, you know, this is a problem, that we really have got a problem.
that probably means there are plenty of problems that we're not identifying.
Mm-hmm. I think when you're opening up a new field, as I think we have, which is just looking at this whole new phenomenon that people just have not been able to detect because they haven't been measuring it, you need to start with low-hanging fruit. So when people look at our data, it's very hard for them to dismiss it because we're very generous in evaluating physician performance. So when we say there was a contextual error, you provided inappropriate care, and we give the example, people are like, yeah, it's true. And even when we use this very generous measure, we're still finding that more than half the time, patients who have contextual issues are walking out with the wrong care plan. So it's a huge problem, and it's not being measured. And I think one of the reasons it's not being measured is that nobody's observing care. You know, and one of the things I think is fascinating is that we're spending $3 trillion in this country right now on healthcare. No one's observing it, literally. So where else does that happen? Right now, care is being evaluated by proxy. It's like what some doc writes in the chart, what some insurance person puts in claims data. What actually happens during the visit, where there is huge variation? I mean, Dr. A may be extremely adept at making sure their patients walk out with the right personalized, contextualized care plan, and Dr. B is completely terrible at it. Their medical records will look exactly the same if they're both following guidelines, okay? Mm-hmm. In fact, Dr. B may look better because he's always following guidelines, even when they don't apply, okay? So I think that we believe that it's time to start observing healthcare. People get skeptical about that. They're like, well, that doesn't really seem scalable, but it's interesting. First of all, in retail, we send secret shoppers into hotels and department stores. So the stakes are a lot lower, right? So to start collecting this data in healthcare is absolutely feasible,
yeah.
Particularly given that there is more than one way you can do it. If you send in actors like mystery patients, there's a cost, or mystery shoppers. It's clearly, if the cost isn't too high to make department stores work well, I don't think it's too high to fix healthcare. But even if you're worried about that, we found that a lot of patients are very comfortable audio recording their visits, mm-hmm. and that doesn't cost anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. So do you think that there are, in sort of assessing doctors who do this well, are there any kinds of ideal behaviors? Is there a typology of this person is really, really good at just... And you guys map this out, I think, quite mm-hmm. nicely. But there are some people who tend to be really generous listeners. Sometimes they'll be along one spectrum where they listen too much and don't maybe recommend or prescribe mm-hmm. enough. Then you have also people who will come into a scenario with sort of a razor-sharp perception of what a potential issue might be before they listen. So you kind of have these different spectra that you outline instead, in place of having, say, ideal character types of, you know, the listener, the lecturer, right?
Yeah, and we've talked about, we've already talked about some of these. For example, is the doc following a kind of prescribed checklist in their mind and they're not going to deviate from that checklist? And mm-hmm. then even when you say, I've lost my job, they're asking about allergies, right? Because that's the right. next thing on the list, right? And because of the way a lot of medical education works, medical students and residents are trained to present in a particular order and to ask questions in a particular way. And, mm-hmm. These are useful mnemonics when you're learning how to take a history or present a history. Mm-hmm. But eventually, you want somebody to get away from that checklist and have some more flexibility and, you know, really attend to the patient and what the patient's saying. So we've talked about that a little bit. One that we haven't discussed that I think is really important is the place of the electronic medical record, that is mm. the computer in the room, or as Saul, I think, likes to say, the doctor-computer relationship, which in some cases takes over the doctor-patient relationship. Mm-hmm. If you've got a doctor who's really focused on their entry into the medical record, it's a very hard to be attentive to a patient and attentive to all of the prompts and the text entry fields in the EMR at the same time. And we can hear this from the recordings when we hear the clicking going on, and, mm-hmm. and the physician has to ask a question a second time because they didn't really hear the answer the first time. That's a serious problem in the encounter.
Imagine if you were trying to do this interview while also having to do a ton of data entry.
Oh, yeah.
So the interview would not go very well. Certainly, you'd have a hard time following us, and particularly if the data entry was highly directive. It says, you know, you need to get the following 15 pieces of information from us, whether we feel like telling you or offer it or not. Mm-hmm. So we want to tell you our story, and you're trying to feed the computer a bunch of information, and you know that ultimately you're going to be evaluated based on how well you entered that data in the computer, not based on how well you addressed our needs. Mm-hmm. That's how healthcare is working right now. And so what are doctors doing? They're doing a terrific job under the circumstances, making everything look good in the computer. Mm-hmm. And obviously, that isn't patient-centered, right? It's not centered on the patient. It's centered on the computer in the literal sense. Now, one of the things that's interesting is we found that when we compared these visits with the fake patients where the doc had either overlooked the contextual red flag or had done a great job of picking up on it. So if we go back to our earlier example, the physician identified that the patient was on an expensive brand name drug and switched them to a generic versus they didn't and they overlooked it. What was fascinating is when we compared those two outcomes, on average, the visit length was the same. And that completely surprised us because we assumed that to contextualize care would take longer, that the physician, and actually whenever we talked about our work before that to physicians, they would say, well, what you're trying to do is all nice and dandy, but we don't really have time for that. We only have 20 minutes for a visit or 15 minutes for a visit. You know, it's, we're just trying to get the biomedical right. But in fact, it isn't, doesn't really work that way because it's not that you do the biomedical first and then if there's time, you do the contextual. It's actually that you're beginning the exam with a wider angle lens. So when the patient says, boy, it's been tough since I've lost my job, you're jumping on that. And then you discover that the patient just needs to be switched to a cheaper generic, and then you're done. And the person walks out with the right care, and it didn't take any longer. In fact, if you miss that, and you go down the biomedical pathway, and you're trying to figure out what medicines to add and what test to order, that's time-consuming, too. And so this, this claim that we can't contextualize care because we don't have time is a misconception.
Mm-hmm. And did you guys, in your framework, actually code for any of these structural factors? Say, you know, overly attentive to computer and data entry, or you know, overly stuck to one's checklist. Because actually, the checklist thing is interesting because that I think touches on bigger conversations about you know medicine and society and risk mitigation. I think Atul Gawande's book has attracted a lot of attention. And in a way, what your framework does is while accommodating and trying to systematize the collection of this information, it does push against what seem to be a more of an attempt at routinization or operationalization. So, have you guys met with resistance in describing this the results of your work and the potential implementations in hospital practice?
I think you asked a few different questions. I'm trying to figure out what to hone in on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what would you like me to focus on?
I'd say let's focus on the actual implementation in the hospital.
Yeah, of this approach?
Yeah.
Well, so right now we have moved into a very exciting quality improvement process. Everything we've been talking about up to now has been research. But because the data has been so compelling, one of my major kind of work homes has been the Veterans Administration, the VA hospital system. They've funded a lot of this work, in fact, most of it. And so the VA is all about applying research to practice. It's all about trying to find better ways to help veterans. And because we have so much evidence that this problem is common, it became, we moved it into the from research into quality improvement. So we went through a process of starting this up at several hospitals where basically physicians couldn't opt out. And which they can in research. And we would invite patients to volunteer to carry audio recorders in the visits on a routine basis. We'd collect those audio recorders. We would code them using 4C. And then when we would generate reports based on the contextual errors and also the great contextualized care, both the positive and the negative, in little reports that we were highly structured. They provided both quantitative data on the performance of physicians, the rate at which they contextualize care, as well as examples of where they don't and where they do. And we would provide those reports and feed them back to the care teams. And the goal was to see if we could improve their performance by simply holding a mirror up to them. If you think about what you're doing is when you secretly audio record visits and you code performance and then you give it back to the people who you've just audio recorded, it's like holding a mirror up to them, and it's just saying this is what you're doing, both good and bad, and giving them an opportunity to build on their strengths and correct their weaknesses. And this whole approach of audit and feedback, as it's called, is considered one of the better approaches to changing how professionals perform. To give you an example, a not very effective approach is just taking them into a classroom and giving them a lecture, saying, you know, this is the problem that people make, because they're all like, well, that's not me, I don't do that.
Right.
But this is like, this is what you look like. Okay, it's a mirror. And so we did that for about 3 years, and there are lots of challenges. There is, first of all, again, the same issue of physicians needing to trust it. We need to make sure, in this case, we had to make sure that the unions were on board, because, you know, they represent the workers. We ended up adding on pharmacists, audio recording them as well, and then ultimately nurses, and then even clerks. We started interviewing audio recording clerks or having our patients audio record them. And so we started providing feedback to everybody. It's a complex process. What I found is that once people trust you, you're going to be successful. But that's probably the biggest challenge, is people realizing that, you know, being secretly audio recorded has to come with a lot of protection, that this isn't going to go to their bosses, their names are going to be removed, that this is truly for professional development.
Right, right. Because what it sounds like is being described is something that could potentially shade into being a managerial technology that many would, you know, resist, and it could be seen as, you know, a tool of bureaucracy. Whereas I think what you're both intending is that this is just a tool for reflection.
Fortunately, there is already a very deep tradition and a legalized process in healthcare called peer review. So protected peer review is present in every hospital. Typically, it's more traditional, which is, as I'm a physician in a local hospital here, and I'm routinely asked to audit the charts of my peers, and they routinely audit my charts. And it's done every 6 months. And then we actually go through it, and we're supposed to be very objective. If we think there are problems, we notate them. And the way the system works is it's protected from subpoena. It can't go to court. It doesn't go to the administration. It's entirely for performance improvement, unless they discover some egregious, you know, negligence. So we basically put it into that legal bucket. So we say this is essentially protected peer review.
It's much more like pitcher being videotaped and watching their tapes to, you know, improve their pitch than it is like Watergate.
Yes, I think that's a great distinction.
That's excellent. And I think another one of the potential implementations of this that you discussed toward the end of the book is in medical education. And so I was particularly struck, as I'm sure others who have read the book have been, by the results that you got when comparing medical students responding to the unannounced standardized patients versus the physicians that you had deployed them to, and how the rate of the medical students was higher, actually, than I think in both cases, the ones who were trained in your workshops on respecting context and those who were not, their rate of context appreciation was higher than those of physicians. Now, both of you point out that that's a contextual situation. Students are performing up to a certain standard. But what were some other interesting things that you observed in trying to implement this in medical schools?
Yeah, in that case, the students knew they were seeing standardized patients, and that was really in many ways the big difference.
Right.
And what that said to us is, you know, just doing an educational intervention, it was a good educational intervention, it was a nice series of workshops, and it did indeed make the students who learned about and had opportunities to practice contextualizing care, they were more competent at it when they were facing these standardized patients, you know. But the moment you take it out of the training environment, out of the classroom, like our attending physicians seeing unannounced standardized patients in their office, you realize that competence is one thing, and actual real world performance is a whole other bar.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we care about real world performance, so that was one of the reasons why we moved to audit and feedback, the approach that Saul discussed, because that really looked like it had the opportunity to change not just competence, what you can do, but performance, what you
actually do. Mm-hmm. It's a very important and interesting distinction, what I'd like to call the skills performance gap, which is a skill is what you can do when you know you're being tested, and performance is what you actually do when you are, don't think anyone's paying attention, right? So we were able to show that when medical students or residents know they're being tested and they're in a lab with a fake patient and they've been trained to contextualize care, they do a good job. But when we sneak patients into their practices who are either real patients or carrying audio recorders or fake patients, they fall back to their old ways. And I think that's just show, it's, you know, it's the, like the Hawthorne effect, right? It's that when people know they're being tested. And so that's why we believe that if you really want to assess this critical part of performance, which meaning what people really do in practice, you have to do it undercover. You have to do it using, not in a malicious way, more like, you know, not with any malice, but if you want to get accurate data on what people actually do, it's the only way to do it.
Mm-hmm. And then just to kind of wrap up our discussion of this book and this work, what do both of you see as the sort of the largest or the most important structural factors sort of that stand in the way of or might hinder the successful implementation of this approach in, you know, a broader format?
I think we've already talked about the issues with the electronic medical record. I think there are also the way that physicians now are paid, even where there's a movement toward pay for performance, the way that performance is measured, as Saul has alluded, is almost entirely through the chart, the medical record. And we know that there are problems with that. And we know that we're likely going to be incentivizing care that is not going to be contextual. Mm-hmm. So I think that's if you want to talk about really big structural changes that need to happen, one of them is at the level of kind of the healthcare payment system.
Mm. I mean, just to again put it very in a very basic sense, we are all motivated by what we know is being measured about our performance, right? So right now, doctors are measured by what they put in the chart. If doctors knew instead that they're periodically being audio recorded, either by patients who are volunteering to do it or fake patients who are coming in, they don't know which ones, that is going to change what they prioritize. And if they know that data is going to be used ultimately, not in any punitive sense, but it's going to be used in the same way chart data is used now, performance assessment. It's going to be used for giving them feedback, for in some cases perhaps determining what their performance pay will be. Then they will having an incentive to put a higher priority on how they actually interact with the patient, and that's critical, because as long as you're not measuring it, it ain't going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, so we discussed this earlier, but I would like to hear from both of you. What are the next steps of this project, or what are some other kind of current research projects that either of you have going that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, we're just about to start a biggie in October. We got a lot of funding to start a project funded through the Veterans Administration to study the QI project itself and to expand it. So we're going to be expanding this QI project, again, where we invite thousands of veterans to audio record their visits and then code that data and feed it back to the practice so they can improve. We're now doing that at two sites in Chicago. We're going to expand it to four sites in Chicago and also to a site in Los Angeles and Cleveland. And then we're going to be collecting several types of data. One is we're going to be looking at whether the feedback process itself leads to better performance as measured by our 4C method. So is it working? Two, is it actually leading to better outcomes for patients? So we'll be tracking those patients over time. And three, is it leading to lower costs? Is it does fixing this problem actually result in less overuse and misuse of medical services? So those are the three biggies. And then in addition, we're going to be doing what's kind of called implementation assessment, where we're going to actually be doing kind of qualitative interviews with doctors, patients, administrators to kind of figure out how they feel about it. Do they think it's working for them? Do they feel safe? And collecting all that data as well.
Mm-hmm. And then outside of the VA and the university, we have a company now that is trying to bring some of these ideas to market, to
provide opportunities for practices and payers to have their visits audio recorded and assessed by unannounced standardized patients for performance improvement.
Mm-hmm. It's a very unusual company because our business is sending fake patients to people, and that's our main product line. And it's called I3PI, which is the Institute for Practice and Performance Improvement. And we actually did a job recently with the American College of Physicians where we sent fake patients to practices in Washington and Virginia. Of course, they knew. And it was fascinating. So we sent in actors who portrayed themselves as having diabetes. And, you know, we discovered that they would come out and with their, you know, they, for instance, the doctor would put in their note that they examined the patient's feet for diabetic sores. And the actor would report that no one took their shoes off. And now that's, unfortunately, doctors are often using templates in the electronic reader. And the default on those templates is a normal exam. So, you know, the doctor just checked normal exam when, in fact, the exam didn't happen. So the feedback we gave to those practices was have your assistants, the nurse assistants, just tell patients to take their shoes off and their socks off if they have diabetes before the doctor walks in. And then we found that when we sent in another wave of fake patients, that this time they were getting the exam. So we were able to fix a problem that no one knew existed. And the only way we could determine that was by sending in these fake patients. So our hope with our company is that people will see this as an opportunity to really find out what kind of care patients are getting.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And actually, I want to wrap up with one more thing, because I usually when I ask this question, it's sort of about the next book, right? And so first, is there another book? And then second, what was it like turning this into a book? And why, you know, a lot of the time, the forum for these this kind of research would be, you know, in the Journal of the American Medical Association or, you know, comparable forums. So why turn this into a book for popular consumption?
Well, we've written all those papers already. I mean, we've written tons of papers for, you know, Annals of Internal Medicine, JAMA, SJIM, all over the place. But we wrote this book because, boy, do we have a story to tell. And you know, it's a very unusual story because this isn't typical boring research where you're sitting at a computer and just crunching data. This is sneaking fake patients into places, asking real patients to audio record their visits, you know, having to deal with frightened bureaucrats and paranoid, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. And so we had a real yarn to tell. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of, you know, people write, you know, kind of doctor books. That are just kind of opinions. This is not opinions. This is a book of hardcore evidence that we have spent 10 years assembling. And, you know, we just felt like it should all be in one place rather than just in a ton of papers.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I hope that one day, though, there might be another book for patients. I think that we might one day be able to study what kinds of things patients can do to try to help their physicians help them. I mean, the responsibility is on the physician to probe and to understand context. But maybe we can identify some ways that patients can either facilitate that or identify those physicians that are going to do it well and seek those physicians.
And I think most of all, we're hoping to light a fire. I mean, we feel like we've come upon something really important that's been in the shadows, a huge problem in healthcare that's fixable. And we're exposing it, and we want other people to start to look at these same issues because we think they're so important, and we alone can't really tackle this problem. All we can do is light a fire.
Great. Well, Saul, Alan, thanks so much for your time. And for those of you listening, this has been another episode of New Books in Medicine. Definitely go and check out Alan and Saul's book. Thanks so much.